Welcome to the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Welcome to Interval Drinks, a podcast by the Royal Shakespeare Company in which we talk to artists who inspire us.
Opening a show, it's just the sort of terror of, is this conceivable? I can remember a sequence of words in front of other humans. I can remember what to do. I cannot fall over. It just might not be actually possible.
Theatre is like Power Rangers. It's like when all the Power Rangers come together and make one big Power Ranger.
Because it's great, and people will have a great time, and people deserve to have a great time, damn it.
Have you collected your drinks? Then let's begin. This week, RSC actor Tom Petty asks fellow actor and director Prasanna Puwanaraja what his interval drink of choice is.
Hello, I'm Tom Petty, and I'm very excited to host this edition of the RSC Interval Drinks podcast, which is an opportunity for current RSC company members to sit down and have an interval drinks chat with someone that inspires them. And there are very few more polymathematic people around than my guest today, whose work spans theatre, film and TV as an actor, writer and a director. I was keen to grab an interval drink with my guest today as we both share a former life as doctors in the NHS, himself as an ENT, ear, nose and throat doctor, and myself as an anaesthetist. Prasanna Puwanaraja is an actor, director and writer, and over the past 15 years or so, he has had an extensive career both on stage and screen, including Dr. Foster, Melrose, Line of Duty, and recently 10%, with The Crown coming up. Theatre-wise, he's worked in the West End, at the National Theatre, Donmar Warehouse, and made his RSC debut back in 2009 in Greg Doran's Twelfth Night. Prasanna is also a writer and a filmmaker, with his debut play Night Watchman performed in 2011 at the National Theatre, and his beautiful short film The Half-Light, which you can find online. His first feature film as director, Bally Walter, completed filming early last year and is currently in post-production. And as if that wasn't enough, last year, he co-wrote a graphic novel, Sleeper, with fellow doctor-turned-creative Jed Mercurio. He returned to the RSC in 2019 to direct Thomas Otway's Venice Preserved, complete with lasers and Madonna voguing. I'm delighted to be joined by Prasanna Puwanaraja. Welcome.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for that lovely introduction.
I feel like I need a drink.
Yeah. Or have you done your vocal warm-up?
Yeah.
How are you getting on today?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm all right.
How's rehearsals going?
Rehearsals are going well. I'm currently in rehearsals for Richard III, which we're in week four. So yeah.
And All's Well.
And All's Well coming up. Yeah. So double bill over the summer. Two very different plays.
And your RSC debut. Congratulations.
It is. Thank you very much. But this is not about me. This is about
we'll see.
You.
So
I'll turn the tables. I'll turn the tables. Now, tell me, are you a fan of the interval? Are you more a kind of 90-minute straight through kind of guy?
I am. I'm a 90-minute straight through kind of guy. Yeah, I think there's a real challenge of making plays about how you get people into the interval, and also how you get them out of it, because you really do surface people, and also they get a chance. I mean, this is maybe not that kind of me, but they get a chance to confer with their friends and relatives and dilute their personal experience of something. And I think it's much more interesting and intriguing to maybe kind of hermetically seal people into their own experience of a thing start to finish. So.
And not be taken out by the interval.
Exactly.
And the drink.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and also I just have memories of kind of, you know, you come back in and someone sort of scratching away at the bottom of an ice cream tub and the lights sort of ignominiously go down to black and you hear people wandering back on and it starts up again and you kind of go, oh, why isn't this over?
why are we back here?
We could just be having a second interval drink.
Yeah. But if I was to force your hand then, because this is the Interval Drinks podcast, you have to have a drink in this interval.
What would be your drink of choice? That's the message of the podcast. It would definitely be a pint, although I am getting older and we've discussed this. So an interval pint is perilous, potentially. But I also have a terrible diet. I'm probably constantly dehydrated, so it probably...
It balances out.
Balances out.
You're in optimum hydration.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Brilliant. Have you ever left in the interval?
Oh, yeah.
Which shows?
Yeah.
It's all right, you don't.
Do you mean of the ones that you've been in?
Yeah.
Right.
All of them?
Yeah. Yes, I have. And I'm sorry to say that I'm also not ashamed of that. I think that theatre is something that you kind of are consistently saying yes to rather than you're trapped there because posh people have made a play and you must listen. It's like, no, you actually, like, you have to fight for people's attention and you have to, you know, there has to be a will to be there. I remember getting told off by a producer once because I managed to procure some free tickets for a show in the West End for some National Youth Theatre members, and all of them left at half time. And this producer said to me, I just thought it was incredibly rude. And I was like, well, no, I think your play was probably not of interest to them, which is a very, very different thing. Yeah. And he really couldn't see that would be the case. He felt that it was some sort of act of kind of cruelty or something. It's like, no, I think, you know, if you're watching a box set and you get to act two and you don't like it, in the privacy of your own home, you just watch something else.
Yeah.
And so
the contract is being written sort of constantly when you come to the theatre, and it feels like it should be like that, so that people don't feel that they're stuck and can respond to something, you know, much, much more honestly, I guess.
I agree. And also it just raises the bar for us making it. It has to be, and it doesn't mean that it has to be thrashy or kind of, I guess, you know, clickbaity or like, you know, it just has to have intrigue for a human soul engaging with it.
Yeah.
I mean, that said, I've been in shows where people have not even waited to the interval before leaving. So, you know, that's nobody's favourite trick. So, you know, you see the lights go down, you go, oh, it was really quite an exodus.
yeah.
Sometimes not even an awkward shuffle. Sometimes it's really like, we just have to, like, it's really important that we're not in this room.
Take me back to, so, you know, you're back in Stratford, you've been back recently, just before the pandemic, directing. But take me back to 2009, you know, playing a smallish part in Twelfth Night, your first RSC job, I think. What's the sensation coming back now, all these years later, and having, I guess, had a relationship with the RSC over time? How does it feel coming back to Stratford? What's that sensation like compared to 2009?
It was very different then. We rehearsed in London, and you guys are rehearsing up here, aren't
we? Are, yeah.
Yeah, in the amazing Other Place, which used to be the Courtyard Theatre, which was where we were performing. And they were at that time doing the redevelopment of the RST. So the whole of the main site was kind of boarded up with red hoardings that just said RSC on it. And it was just a building site down there. We were really the only company in Stratford. It was kind of the winter. So it felt actually like, I guess, what the RSC, what Stratford might feel like if the RSC wasn't here, in a way. It was just a play in a town in the Midlands. So there was something quite sort of small scale about it, something quite low key. And then 1,000 people would turn up every night to watch the show, sort of out of nowhere. And I loved that theatre. I think it was one of the most wonderful, certainly one of the most wonderful Thrust spaces that I've seen and worked in. And Thrust stages are all about like weird, mercurial architectural physics. You know, there's a kind of dark art, I think, to like designing them. And now, like coming here now after the pandemic, and the town is buzzing again. Watched the Henrys yesterday, which were great, and it was really nice to get the buzz back around that main site, you know. So it really felt very different. And also just that thing of being in more than one play, the kind of squeeze of lime that you get going from, I guess you'll get it when you start your All's Well rehearsals on Monday, bouncing from room to room.
Yeah.
You know, there was really none of that. I mean, we were sort of in a micro rep with Arabian Nights, which was actually the play that I thought they were phoning about when they called with the audition, because I'd just been fired by my agent at that point. So they phoned me directly. And I was like, oh, yes, Arabian Nights. They went, no, Twelfth Night. And I was like, oh, really? I did end up in a big beard, though. So, they knew who they got.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But those early experiences for actors, myself included, where you come and do small roles in rep, those opportunities aren't too common now in actors' kind of early careers, are they? The opportunity to do rep, to have that training. How do you think we can train actors and support actors in the early career? And I say this slightly with a nod to your association with National Youth Theatre and other non-traditional drama school routes of training, which has previously been that's the way you become an actor.
What
can we be doing in the industry to make sure that we've got different routes in and then early career support?
Well, I mean, I think this is a deeply unfashionable thing to say, particularly in Stratford, particularly in an RSC podcast, but I think television is the new rap in terms of opportunities for actors coming out of training, just pure employment opportunities, but also the opportunity to kind of work on stuff by contemporary writers. That's where new writers are rapidly moving into. So the real danger, I think, for theatre, the kind of existential danger really for theatre, is that you actually can't train people professionally for big theatre spaces because those opportunities are just not there. And when they are there, actually it's really, really difficult to get them. I mean, you've been auditioning for the RSC for a couple of seasons now. So they were clearly kind of interested in you joining the company. It's just difficult to find the space to place everyone that they're really interested in developing the careers of. Whereas I think 25, 30 years ago, you would have been in Birmingham, you'd have been in Newcastle, you'd have been in Edinburgh, you'd have been in, wherever, Pitlochry, and there would have been the demand for you to be in all of those places. So I don't know if there's any, it's really hard to kind of get into a kind of hand-wringing space about the rep, like a nostalgic space about the rep, because I really think it has kind of, theatre is sort of like independent cinema now. It's like, it's really a rarity that we have to absolutely protect. And actually, I'm going to flip this back to you as a recent grad. How much do you feel drama school prepped you for that enormous theatre, for the demands of these complex texts? Because you're talking about, I mean, we used to consider it as it's coming up here is like a cup final, it's like playing for England at Wembley. And Lambda is like the under 21s. And not everyone who plays in the under 21s moves into that other space. And it's not always necessarily the right people or the whatever it is, but like, how does the training map on, do you think?
Well, I think these things take you to a certain level, don't they? And I draw the parallel really with medicine, which we both have a shared experience of 6 years at medical school, and then getting to that point where you are nominally a doctor. And the same with drama school, they have two, three-year courses, and they put people out as actors. But that's when the apprenticeship really starts, and that may be through theatre jobs, it may be through TV, radio, whatever it is. And I think we have to kind of accept that and embrace that when, for instance, the RSC has quite a kind of program within the rep companies of doing these plays, of doing Greg's Shakespeare Gyms, which, for those who haven't heard of them, is an opportunity to take an hour or two out of the rehearsal and talk about rhetoric or talk about verse and do a sort of practical experience, so that there is a training element to being part of the rep company. And I think drama schools have a very difficult job, and my experience of going to drama school later in life kind of made me realise that it does some great stuff, it also doesn't achieve some things, but then maybe it's not meant to achieve everything.
I kind of think there's really practical things in, like taping, which is essentially auditioning in the contemporary world for actors, which is just the most humiliating thing to do with friends and colleagues, stand there in your house with a sort of rubbish little phone camera doing these scenes where you don't know the context. I mean, it's really, that's an art form, actually, like people who are able to do great tapes, inventing things out there. It's like, acting in front of a tennis ball in a VFX film, I've sat on Q&A panels with recent grads who talk about, just having to be real in order to be able to do an audition tape. I can't redo it on my own. I just need another actor there to like play off them. And I'm like, that's absolutely great. But, when you get on the, get into a sound stage at Long Cross, and there's a sort of grip up a ladder holding a tennis ball going, this is the dinosaur's head. Can you start your scene? And an assistant director reading the other lines, kind of witheringly badly, then it's like, yeah, that's acting.
And it's a long way removed from.
It's a long way removed. And no one ever tells you how to do that, because that stuff can feel so fake if what you've come from is a landscape of training through Meisner or something, which is all about like the whites of the eyes.
Yeah.
And the kind of, you know, the prickle of the skin. It's like there's no prickle of the skin when it's that situation. So, or like, look at this cross on the camera because we can't fit the actor in this corner. You know,
going back to Venice Preserved, which was staged in the Swan in 2019, what was your kind of process with the RSC of finding that play? And then it was a very distinctive production in terms of its modernity and the design, for one thing, which had, you know, a lot of elements of kind of light, and it's very textural in terms of lasers and wetness, you know, actors coming out of a hole in the stage absolutely drenched. It had a real kind of noir feeling to it. How do you start out from that first conversation to arriving at that? What were the challenges?
Well, that was a play that was gestating for me for about 8 or 9 years. It was a thing that I developed for an award called the JMK Award, which is an award for emerging directors. Under the age of 30, lol. I'm not under the age of 30.
It's a podcast.
Yeah.
I can't see.
I mean, they recently upped the upper limit, the age limit, to 35, because they were like, you know, people are emerging for a very, very, very long time and arguably never really stop emerging. But so it was and it's a restoration play, 1682, I think. I had read it because it was on a JMK list, and it also has this kind of acting folklore thing, you know, these enormous kind of clanging two-handed scenes, like the very best scenes in Julius Caesar or Othello, that are all about idea, like psychology linked to rhetoric, linked to ideas, linked to sort of emotional stakes, everything happening at once. It's kind of the perfect Swan material, you know. I was reading it going, every single scene here is taking place at night. Whenever people talk about time, they talk about meeting at midnight. Like, it's built in, is this noir engine. Was then also, you know, it was kind of, it's about sociopathic, toxic men talking about how the collapse of their city is only rescuable by interventions by themselves. So it's basically Gotham. It's the fall of the city and the rise of the psycho. And I think those things are not that much of a push, to be honest. It's actually kind of weirder and more distancing to put it in 1680s settings, which we really have known nothing about. And actually, they're completely borrowed anyway. Like, our sense of what the world is in the 1680s is fake. You know, we never see people who aren't white in those things. And there were, you know, tens of thousands of people who weren't white. I think like 6% of the population of London was not white in the 17th century. So not dissimilar to the national population now. So, you know, there are so many things that feel alien, even if you put it then. So I was just kind of not interested in that. That whole process was me talking to my designer. And what I tend to do is I start with images and music, and I read around a place or a sort of time. And there'll always be a kind of thing that I find that you kind of grow the crystal off. And with that play, it was actually about the sense that Venice is a city of facades, and it's a city of, it's a very, very, I mean, if you think about it, it's a city built on stilts, you know, enormous kind of cedar trunks. We were into that kind of place. And then Greg, I think, was interested in doing the play. They'd never done it here. He was talking about the Garrick anniversary, the 250th anniversary of the Garrick Shakespeare Jubilee, and wanted to do a couple of plays celebrating David Garrick, and Venice Preserved was one of those. And he phoned and sort of said, I know you've got a take on this play. Do you want to do it? And I was like, great. I mean, I thought you just wanted to, you know, just maybe use the cut that I had or something. In truth, I think Greg was kind of going, this is a pretty tricky play to persuade anyone else to do. It's a bit of a hospital pass. It's like 4.5 hours long if you don't cut it. like directors not lining up to do a very problematic sheet tragedy without the kind of having done the microsurgery on it. So I phoned my designer and I was like, hey, it's on this play that we worked on 8 years ago. And he was like, I literally last week put our old model box in the bin. Correct. Okay. So but that's fine. Cause we had to start again and everything from scratch. And, like you say, we bought a laser machine on eBay, I think, from some club in East Berlin, Nina Dunn, our video designer. And then we discovered that the RSC's video department contained within it a guy called Mike, who told us that he loved lasers, he loved laser machines, and he used to work for the company that made this laser machine. And at the laser company, his nickname was Laser Mike.
I mean, that's pretty impressive at a laser company to be the one who's called
exactly.
Laser Mike.
So Laser Mike was absolutely thrilled, and he did a safety briefing about this laser. And it was one of my, because you know what those health and safety briefings can be like. They can kind of go on and on. And he just went, okay, everyone, don't look directly into the laser. And that was the briefing.
It's sensible advice.
Yeah, I was like, listen, Mike, we're gonna get on like a house on fire. But he sort of animated, and he worked out sort of with Nina's software plugins to be able to talk to this machine from the 80s. Yeah. And so we created prisms. And
it was pretty spectacular and strange to see on the Swan stage, really.
It was weird with sort of, you could see the sort of woody balconies and stuff behind. It was a kind of textural mismatch, but, that's all right.
Now, you've never really escaped medicine, it seems to me, and you've played a few doctors along the way. I know you work with Jed Mercurio now quite closely on several projects. We've previously talked about a role you played in Critical when you were an anaesthetist. I've never seen an anaesthetist handle a laryngoscope quite with the flair that you did. You're kind of left, there's something still lingering, isn't there, from medicine, and I wonder how difficult that transition was from the identity of being a doctor and everything that comes with that through training to leaving that behind, and what you're left with now, what resonance you're left with.
It was quite a slow crossfade, actually, and it was initially about just not being happy at work, basically. And I think when you're quite young, it can be quite hard to actually say that to yourself, particularly when you're like, this is what I should be doing. I've been training for this. And when you discover that you're just not the right build for it in some way. And there are various markers for that, but, the way that I would dissociate myself from that work was just the kind of, and this, like, this is not particularly cryptic, but, it's just, I was like, this, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this for 40 years. And so initially I was just taking a bit of time away, fully intending to go back, and actually immediately just preferred who I was, particularly when I was doing creative things. So I don't think there was a kind of like eureka moment or moment where I actually had to decide how I felt about that. But then in time I was kind of looking back, and, you just kind of reflect on things, and actually there's a lot of positive stuff around, I guess, like thought processes and a kind of scientific analysis headspace that I guess we're always in as medical people. I mean, I think everything is a set of symptoms of something. I think, plays are about trying to work. I mean, subtext is essentially a clinical condition underpinning a set of symptoms, isn't it? Mm. And so, the route into a play is the same as the route into a kind of fairly complex patient, I think. It's a bit reductive, that, but there's definitely a mapping on of the two things. I have a lot of guilt around not doing it, I would say. Particularly around the pandemic, and I know you were working throughout the pandemic. I mean, I volunteered and applied to go back and got re-registered, actually, and the NHS said no thanks, which is it was a bit of a low blow in the pandemic.
They must have seen your priest in 12
Yeah, nights. Exactly. Yeah, they were like, well, this is a global pandemic. We don't want this to be a complete shit show, so that was an offer that was sent back.
What does that feel like? Because you... I'm just pressing this slightly, you know, identity, and there are parallels with being an actor. You invest so much in the identity of being a doctor or of being an actor, so that when you're not doing it, there's a weird sort of liminal space that can be occupied. And we like to identify as something, don't we? And I wonder if that will ever kind of leave you. Your project during the pandemic, Fear Fatigue, was it?
Fear Fatigue.
Yeah, you worked on that.
Yeah, I think there's a sort of... and I'm now working on a three-part drama about the experience of healthcare professionals in the first weeks of the pandemic and then into the first year with Jed Mercurio and also a doctor called Rachel Clark. So I think there's a kind of thing where I'm interested, as I'm sure you are, in the platforming possibilities of being a writer or a creator of things to talk about the things that maybe the media doesn't cover or Twitter doesn't cover, which is about trying to dig out experiences and share them in a sort of unmolested way, but also having an understanding of what those spaces are actually like, so that things don't feel like a bunch of theatre makers or telly makers going, oh, this is probably what a hospital is like, and you know, everyone kind of feels like this, because most people's sense of the NHS is basically Holby or Casualty. So when they go into the NHS, there's a sort of expectation, reality mismatch, which can lead to kind of a huge disappointment in terms of their experience of being in the NHS with all of its challenges and the enormous wait times and the exhaustion of the staff and the stressed resources. Yeah. And it isn't just people stood around talking about dating at the nurse's station. It's people run ragged and, you know,
and there's an activism in that, I think, I sense from you. And I've seen it in Jed's very early work, Jed Mercurio's work, when Cardiac Arrest was his first sort of big TV series and was phenomenally successful because it felt very gritty and real. And actually, I rewatched it a couple of years ago and thought,
good, isn't it?
Yeah, this is not far off.
Yeah.
But it's not like the medical soaps that we digest.
I mean, I think when he first made that, I think a lot of eyebrows went up. At the broadcaster, because they were like, this is not what the NHS is like. And he was like, well, it is, because I come from the NHS. And I think what you're saying is your experience of it from the work that you've commissioned and made is not like this. There are so many things about that that are in absolute correlation with Shakespeare. So there's a kind of like trodden in understanding of what those plays are. This feels like I'm trying to get away from that medicine question. I'm really not. But like, I think this is interesting. Like, when you try and pull apart a play like Venice Preserved, and people go, well, you know, you can't do that, or you must do this, or whatever it is, it's actually quite flimsily based, you know. So when Peter Brook did his Miss Sunrise Dream, a production that would probably not seem particularly avant-garde now, which completely blew the doors off when it emerged, was actually itself knocking against a kind of post-Victorian, this is what Shakespeare should be, which climbed out of a thing that would have been much more full-throated, fighting for an audience in the open air. So actually, no one really knows what the true theatrical antecedents of Shakespeare are. Therefore, all bets are kind of off. I think one of the nice things about doing Venice Preserved is no one knew that play, like literally no one knew that play. So there's a big opportunity, I think, as theatre fights for its space, to kind of reclaim the plays for a new era of viewers who are sort of interested potentially in other things.
And going back to our previous conversation about the sort of sanctity of theatre and the fact that, you know, sometimes an interval isn't the best thing and sometimes something straight through which hits you hard and fast might be the thing that engages new audiences, and the relaxed and chill performances that are available where people can get up and go out and come back in and, you know, feel able to be more sort of themselves, essentially, rather than the stiff sitting in a seat for an hour and a half.
Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. The performance is about to continue.
So if, let's imagine you've gone to a show with an interval, you've chosen to do this, you've stayed, who would you choose to have your interval drink with if you could? Who would be your partner?
So I'm going to say it is a friend of ours, Jonathan Lightfoot, and who is an old friend and colleague of mine from the health service, and likewise with you, who's an anaesthetist in the west of England. Firstly, because I didn't think, you know, I would want to resurrect Gandhi and take him to the theatre. I'm sure he's got better things to be doing in the karmic afterlife. Secondly, I miss him and I haven't seen him for a long time. And thirdly, he is someone at the interval who you don't have to perform to. You know, sometimes you don't want to unpack your thoughts. And he's the only friend that I've got, I think, who comes to see shows and absolutely tells me what he thinks. So, you know, I think that's what I cherish most at an interval, is just a bit of realness.
Mm. Prasanna Pawanaraja, thank you very much for joining me for this Interval Drinks podcast today. And hope to see you back at an interval in the RSC very soon.
Thanks very much for having me, Tom, and good luck with rehearsals. Good luck with rehearsals, and congrats again on your debut.
Thank you.
Remember, you can listen again to past episodes on the Royal Shakespeare Company website. Search RSC Interval Drinks to listen to more episodes, including Series 1 of Interval Drinks.